Underground civilizations link with the hollow earth theory. There are supposedly races that exist in subterranean cities beneath planet Earth. Very often, these dwellers of the world beneath are more technologically advanced than we are on the surface. Now, some believe that UFOs are not from other planets at all, but are manufactured by strange beings in the interior of the planet. In the late 17th century, British astronomer Edmund Halley proposed that the Earth consists of four concentric spheres and also suggested that the interior of the planet was populated with life and lit by a luminous atmosphere. He thought the aurora borealis, or northern lights, was caused by the escape of this gas through a thin crust at the poles. In the early 19th century, an eccentric veteran of the War of 1812, John Simms, promoted the idea of interior concentric sphere so widely that the alleged opening to the inner world was named Simms Hole. Jules Verne wrote Journey to the Center of the Earth in 1864, and Edgar Rice Burroughs, the creator of Martian Adventures and Tarzan of the Apes, also wrote novels set in the hollow earth. Legends often ignite the imagination of fiction writers, and fiction often ignites the imagination of the pseudoscientist. What is in the hollow earth? A theory coming up, reptoids. In a moment, cryptozoologist John Rhodes on Coast to Coast AM. Crypto hunter John Rhodes has been building bridges of understanding between the reptile amphibian studies and UFOs. Regarded as a pioneer in the UFO community, he's one of the first to investigate and promote the subject of reptoids or reptilians. John has acted as a consultant and appeared on many television shows, and recently appeared on the Discovery Channel's Animal X, speaking about the 1988 reptoid or lizard man encounters in Bishopville, South Carolina. John's out-of-the-box perspectives and open-minded scientific viewpoints have made him a very popular public speaker, both nationally and internationally, and he has lectured and held workshops at numerous UFO conferences and will be a featured speaker at Victoria Jack's Bay Area UFO Conference in San Jose, California, in October. My pleasure to introduce you to John Rhodes. Hi, John. How are you? John?
I'm doing great, George.
There
How are you?
You are. Okay. I thought you were in the center of the planet for a moment.
Yeah, it's a long wave that would carry it.
Let's talk. Before we get into reptoids, I want to get a better understanding of things that could be in the center of this planet, because that, I think, will be helpful to all of us in this discussion. Of course, I always like to talk a little bit about what Admiral Richard Byrd did on his trips to the North Pole and the South Pole. You know, in his diary, if it's true, and I want to get your take on that, he tells of entering the hollow interior of the planet along with others, traveling 17 miles over mountains, lakes, rivers, vegetation, animal life. Eventually, he says they were greeted by flying machines of a type that he had never seen before, escorted to a safe landing area where he was graciously greeted by emissaries from another era. And, you know, they told him, hey, you know, you are a man of high standing and moral character. That's why we allowed you to come in. And they were concerned about the atomic bombs at the time. And off the Admiral went again. And then in 56, there's talk that he led an expedition to the South Pole and that he and his crew penetrated 2,300 miles into the center of the planet and that he wrote about seeing a sun and things like that. Is this all true? Is this a myth?
Well, we have to understand that we're talking about many years of belief before the UFO phenomenon fully hit human society as a social issue, that people were talking about the inner Earth at those times. It was their form of discussion of what we would, you know, the fringe were talking about the hollow Earth. When it comes to thinking about what our governments and such might think, we have to remember in 1838, in fact, the U.S. Congress allotted $300,000 to find a pathway to open up a trade route to a civilization that was thought to live far to the north. And you've got to remember, that's not so long ago history. Now, of course, if you brought this up before the House, they would just laugh at you. And they might think something different, but they would laugh at you as long as the cameras were on.
Yeah.
As far as birds concerned, we have to remember that some of the stuff about the diary and such of Bird's diary has been based upon people who have picked up upon what Bird actually said during the radio transmissions and afterwards, and they may have concocted some sort of lengthy things about how he flew into the earth and met emissaries and this, that, and the other. And we have to remember that's going to happen no matter what. When you get a good story, somebody's going to embellish it. And I think that's the case in what happened there. However, I have to clarify, when the Nazis surrendered in 1945, several U-boats were unaccounted for. And there were rumors that a secret operation by the name of Paperclip, which we may have heard a lot about in recent history, was actually trying to pursue the top scientists of the German forces
yeah.
as they abandoned there. And they did actually find, I think it was U-boat 530 and U-977, to be specific, were actually found out along the coast of South America. And this whole issue brought up, you know, the boys of Brazil. You know, there was these rumors, of course, after the war, and then, you know, several high-ranking German officers were found down in that area. If the Nazis at that time had really wanted to go somewhere beforehand and set up a base, that would be the appropriate area, because once the Antarctica covers the entire southern part of the planet, from the shores of Antarctica, you could pretty much go anywhere. And those trade routes and those shipping routes have to go around the Cape in those southern areas, and they would be victims of U-boat attacks. So when Byrd went down there, he actually took a fully armed battle group with him. Why? Because they knew that there were some subglacial wolf packs hanging out in there. Wanted to go down and find them to rout out those guys before any of them got any ideas about continuing onto the Fourth Reich. And when he got down there, there were ammunitions taken, there were weapons taken, there was the aircraft. And when he went down beyond that point of where we say he entered the Hollow Earth, he was actually talking about going beyond a certain location. That's what's led everybody to the mystery of what exactly did he mean by going to the land beyond. Because beyond what? If you're 2,300 miles beyond the pole, you're actually on the other side of Antarctica.
Exactly.
And coming to water again. People say
at least you're supposed to be.
At least you're supposed to be. People say it's ridiculous, actually, to think of the Earth being hollow and with big openings down there, but there are very, very few times have there ever been satellite photos that show the North Arctic or the Antarctica completely free of clouds. And people say if there was a hole down there, people haven't fallen into it. They make all the jokes on the TV shows
yeah.
and such.
Well, what
they
don't know is
about a hole that's 800 miles in diameter.
Yeah,
if you're walking up to it, you wouldn't really
You wouldn't even know you were doing it. It's right. It would be such a small, slight curve.
Right.
You know, it would be almost like when you look at, the end of a sea or something, it looks flat.
Right. And he did make the comment about seeing the great land beyond the sky. And if you were actually going over a region like that, it would be like going over a huge endless hill. You would just see the horizon just slowly and slowly start lifting up above your head.
And if you were flying over it, following the land, you would go right into it.
You would go right into it. And of course, you'd your instruments on board the craft. I'm a pilot. I know that your instruments, when they start getting around anything that's anomalous like that, that there's electromagnetic disturbances that are going to throw your instruments off, and it's going to be hard to navigate. And he was in uncharted territory anyway, so rather than stick around to go any further, he probably made the best and safest choice, which was to return.
Many ancient civilizations philosophically state that there's the region that's inside the planet is called Agartha. And they say that it was first colonized thousands of years ago when a holy man led a tribe to the underground, and that these people had immense scientific knowledge in expertise, and they may be onto something based on your theories when we get into the reptoids in a moment, John. We may be talking about the same thing, but with different beings.
Mm-hmm. Whether it's not just the reptoids that are living underground, let me make that quite clear.
Okay.
Concentrating on the reptoids, but there are other beings that are living in union with them and quite peacefully. They just can't imagine allowing a bunch of humans underground and mixing all that up.
So this ancient philosophy that the first colonization might have occurred thousands of years ago might be true then.
It might be true, and it would certainly answer a lot of the Genesis origins, the ancient people from around the world, when they talk about how they were first born, they're all talking about coming from underground. And even in the ancient accounts of Genesis, the first two, they were living in caves, and they hadn't seen the sun before. It was a new thing to them. So when you're talking about being cast out of the garden, there's a lot of people in metaphysics and philosophy that believe the garden was actually the interior of the earth, and the exterior is outside, because you have the harshness of weather, you have the beating sun, you have different types of insects and different animal lives you have to worry with, and more so than anything, you also are susceptible to any kind of a climatological or extraterrestrial threat that approaches the planet. I can't stress that enough, that what drives intelligent species underground is a recognition of such a threat and a wish to continue their race and their species beyond any kind of a devastating event.
Do we know what came first, the underground civilization or the above-ground civilization?
Well, that's kind of hard to tell. I mean, it's an area of science that I haven't dwelled that much into, because we're talking about amino acids and such like that. We know now that there's life forms being found called extremophiles, and they're called extremophiles because they're found in extreme environments deep under the ground, also deep under the ocean near volcanic events, and they're living and existing quite nicely in a atmosphere and in a situation that would be deadly to most other animal life. So when we think about where creatures could live, we just cannot think within the parallel lines that we've established for ourselves as far as our vision of what could be and what couldn't be underground.
John, do you think governments are aware of all this?
I believe this is one of the biggest secrets that there has ever been. And I also believe that that there has been an effort on behalf of military-industrial corporate complex industries to continue our pointing to outer space in search for answers about aliens or extraterrestrials, when in fact we should be searching under our very feet for those same creatures or people that are coming from far off our planet. They wouldn't turn around and go back on a day trip. They would leave somebody here, or they would park their craft under some underground somewhere. And if there are creatures that have existed on Earth long before we ever were even sentient beings, then the underground seems like the natural place to actually be, and allow a civilization to grow up from its genesis without knowledge of your presence.
What I find so fascinating is so much of this ancient culture and historians and authors and people who have written about that, some of it, of course, being fiction, but they all seem to think that there's something going on in there, in the center of the planet. And that, to me, is a pretty astounding theory.
Well, remember that the center of the planet itself is a theory. Nobody has yet actually sent anything physical down to obtain any physical evidence that any of these theories or hypotheses based on blackboards by men who push their eyeglasses up towards the bridge of their nose and live by a pencil sharpener, that their opinion is any better than any one of ours. There have been some great breakthroughs in human histories by people with no educations, and so it should not be underestimated the intelligence of the average person to think and discover the truth beyond that of anybody that's being paid, in government grants to keep their mouth shut.
Is the existence of a hollow earth or subterranean earth important in your reptoid theory?
It is, in as much as when you start recognizing that there's so much in antiquity to indicate that there was some sort of a reptilian presence on our planet, not only just physically, but also it's been a it's been turned into a philosophy, almost a religion, because there's so much of human psychology mixed in with the reptilian part of our brains and how we're identifying with this subject that it's going to take some time to blow. But one of these days, we're all going to suddenly wake up and find out we've all been had, and we've been looking in the opposite direction of where we should have been.
And it was right under our nose.
It was under our feet. They say the best place to hide something is right in front of them.
That's true, right under your feet, literally. John, tell me a little bit about you and how you got involved in this.
Well, I got involved in this a number of years ago. I was working as a professional actor in New York City, much like all the other people who kind of get out of that profession and end up doing other things. I mean, the Pope Paul, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, all these guys, Sean David Morton. I started looking into this issue when I was watching TV one night, and I started hearing about the Roswell case. And Glenn Dennis, who is the mortician in Roswell, New Mexico, when the craft supposedly crashed there, had said that the nurse that he knew actually drew a illustration of what the creature's hand looked like. And when she described it, and you look at this, you're talking about these circular pads on their fingertips. And for somebody like myself who is interested in reptiles and amphibians and such, I recognize that as an earmark of a reptilian physical construct. In tree lizards, they have these little circular pads on their fingertips that have microscopic barbs in them, and they look like suction pads, but they're actually used to hold on to smooth surfaces. And so when I heard that, in as much as what its hand looked like, and then Wendell Stevens and other people had written about how this creature had beaded skin like a lizard, the two things were just grabbed me. And I suddenly realized why the UFO community has been concentrating on the physical evidence of the crash itself and being steered away from this phenomenal description of what this creature looked like.
I love your theory, by the way. You know, I've gone through a lot, and I mean, this is just exciting. You know, tomorrow I've got a roundtable discussion, John, called God, Man, and E.T. with,
yes, I heard,
with Richard Hoagland and Michael Heiser and Hugh Ross, and it's just something I've been looking forward to a long time. But you are, and David Flynn, by the way, you are as exciting to talk about with this theory, because there aren't a lot of people who do this. And, I mean, it makes you wonder just what the heck's going on this planet, because it mixes what I really like, and that's real science with the possibilities of something that could be very paranormal.
Right. You know, and when you're talking about this, you're also talking about how artists and people like that throughout history have been used as vehicles for promoting a future technology to audiences. Jules Verne, all the great ones, Arthur C. Clarke. I loved Arthur C. Clarke, as we'll discuss later. Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book, Childhood's End, and we'll discuss that later during the show, and I'll come back to it because it's a nice build-up to it, because actually there is evidence all around us that we are being prepared for eventual contact with some sort of a threat from off this planet in order to bring down all international borders and unite all humanity, and the threat will be posed in some sort of a physical form that actually we are highly reactive to because of 2,000 years of indoctrination by religions and such in the Western world, that when something like this arrives, we will be armed and ready before we even ask questions, which is something I'm not looking forward to, but I have a feeling that we're headed towards that.
Maybe sooner than you think, John.
It might be. Some people have targeted 2012 because it was the end of the Mayan calendar. Tonight, for the first time, I'm going to also be discussing, at a little bit of length, not in great length, the connections between England, where the crop circles are happening, and Mexico City, where the UFO activity has
all
been
right,
increasing since 1990.
Well, when we come back, we will find out John's take on just what a reptoid is. We'll also talk a little bit about that 1988 lizard man encounter in Bishopville, South Carolina, that he's got a lot of knowledge of. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, my favorite newsletter magazine is called the After Dark Newsletter. I write a column for it every month, and it's got all kinds of fascinating stories tied directly into Coast to Coast AM. We We're talking about Dr. Morgus in the July issue, as well as Zero Point Energy and a number of other issues. If you don't have this as a subscription, well, what are you waiting for? A couple ways to do it. Toll free, you don't need a computer. You can just call this number, 1-888-727-5505. 1-888-727-5505. The other way, of course, is to go to the coasttocoastam.com website, click through the orange type to that secure server, and get your 14 issues for the price of 12. And also, Lex tells me that there's also another easy way to link right up to Coast to Coast. It was a secret, and Lex, of course, has told it to us because we forced him to. It's CTOC. That's it. CTOC.com. It's simple as that, and that'll get you right to the coasttocoastam.com website, too. So a lot of ways to get there. And welcome to Coast, I'm George Norrie, John Rhodes, my guest. John, tell me a little bit about the Reptoids Research Center.
We established the Reptoids Research Center back, got it on the internet in 1997. And it was actually established after I was already speaking on speaking circuits and trying to turn everybody's head around at some of the UFO conventions to look in the opposite direction. I had been doing that for a number of years before. It was kind of difficult to get everybody to, you know, to think of a different perspective. But we opened the research center up, and over the last years, we've been going around and interviewing people who claim to have had contact with these beings. The most impressive thing I've noticed is some of these people don't even really want to talk about it because they're bothered by the subject. Hmm. They don't want any, they wished it had never happened. They don't want to write books, and these are the type of people that I feel are good candidates for people who are actually talking about a real event rather than something that might be fictitious in order to get on stage or, you know, just to have people listen to them. And when I started recognizing that some of these people were people in established authority here in the United States, for gosh sakes, you know, we have people from all different walks of life having seen a creature like this and reporting it, and nobody wanting to listen to them. And as with the center, we've been actually able to go down there, talk to those individuals, review the given circumstances of the area, look for the physical or trace evidence that might be there. We do character profiles on everybody. We try and see if there's a reason that these people might be lying. On occasions, we've actually hooked up cameras without their knowing it on location and seen people, you know, plant evidence to make it look like something was there, so they were trying to fool us. And that's the great use of trail cameras, because you don't have to be there to take a snapshot. And what's really interesting is that a lot of these people really do believe they saw something. And in many cases, it has psychologically been torturous for them because they've had to adjust their life after.
Yeah, it has been life-changing. It's been dramatically life-changing for a lot of these people, hasn't
exactly.
it,
exactly, and especially not only when you encounter something humanoid that may or may not have stepped out of a craft or cave, but when you see something with scales and vertical slit pupils that's standing there perhaps 7.5 feet tall like a linebacker, it's so intimidating that many people instantly feel that they're having some sort of a paranormal or demonic event because of what we've been told for over 2,000 years and what some people still try and use today, the fear of the serpent image that's ingrained in us from this indoctrination, to stand toe to claw with something like that is very difficult to overcome and get used to. A lot of people, their lives have been disrupted. And when people say, well, I want to be hypnotized because I want to find out what happened, I'm often one to say, are you sure? Because we might have we might have voluntary, you know, or involuntary amnesia on this because we don't really believe that we could adjust it to our real lives. And just as the housewife would ignore the lipstick on her husband's collar, we'll ignore something even though it's standing directly in front of us if it means that that's the only way to maintain our sanity. And these creatures are imposing. They're they when they have contact with people, there's a more of a psychic connection that's taking place than anything that's speech. In some occasions, you know, these beings have been seen to be diminutive and small, like the grays. On other times, they've been seen to, in their variations, some have wings. They're called the Draco. And the Draco are the classical image of Satan. And it's almost interesting to think of how that image could be adapted.
Like a fallen angel, maybe, John?
Like a fallen angel, yeah. But, you know, anytime something's demonized, the reason, you know, why the Satan image a long time ago was even given a crooked nose is because somebody decided they didn't like people with crooked noses, so they were going to attach it to the character and then promote that forever after. So, you know, that's part of the indoctrination. But when you're looking at something like that, and it's actually occurring in front of you, I think that...
well, it scares the heck out of you. That's
does. Yeah. You know, even though I've been investigating this for this many years, I've seen the genuine sincerity of some of these contactees. Not all of them, I would say, but maybe 85% of them are... There's something amiss in their story, and there's something not connecting.
That's a huge percent. Let's get into the specifics, John, for a moment, on what you think these reptoids are, first of all.
Well... Personally, I believe that life is diverse on our planet. We know that we've uncovered perhaps 2.5% of all life on Earth we have cataloged, and scientists actually recognize these creatures. That means that there are an additional 97.5% we have not yet come in contact with. And some of these creatures can be quite large, as we've seen recently. And, God, everybody's mind was blown when they discovered, you know, the hobbits. Because we just weren't expecting that.
Right.
And these creatures or beings may have actually been, like the birds many millions of years ago, evolved from dinosaur survivors. Some of the dinosaurs actually survived to become birds. They actually miniaturized themselves and morphologically changed over time because of radiations and different types of mutations and such like this to become birds. And it took us this long to even recognize that. That some of these beings or creatures may have been pre-adapted to an underground life, perhaps down even in Antarctica, where dinosaurs did live at one time. And because of the extreme colds and the darkness, these creatures would have sought the underground during the summer months so they could live in darkness because their eyes were specifically being adapted to a dark environment. And in order to get warm, they'd also want to get out of the cold. And there's a lot of ancient volcano systems that are inactive down there that creatures could have retreated into. You got to remember, it's the nature of a serpent or a reptile to go underground. So this is a natural draw.
I mean, did they have arms and legs, or did they crawl around?
No, at that time, I believe that they were more like a traditional dinosaur.
Okay.
That was like a troodont dinosaur, which is upright. It stands. It was standing about 4 to 5 feet tall. The creature had opposable thumbs. Its eyes had slowly over time started to come forward to be more of a stereoscopic view, so you could actually see in stereo, so you can be a better predator.
Did it have a tail?
It had a tail, absolutely, and lipless mouth, ears that, you know, weren't no ears, flat sides of the head and such. And that these creatures, during the devastation that wiped out their northern cousins, as it got colder and colder and more inhospitable, I believe that they may have actually retreated into the underground. And over millions of years could have adapted to large underground tunnels and caverns that are deep under the earth. And if without solar radiations beating down on them, their genetics would allow them to mutate along a more natural design. And over millions of years, I believe that they may have become these humanoid beings. My belief is not totally unsupported. There is a scientist by the name of Dale Russell, and Dale Russell had been working with the Canadian Museum of Nature up in Ottawa, Canada, and he actually worked with another colleague of his named Ron Seguin. They came up with a model of something that looked like a humanoid dinosaur after they had taken the Troodon dinosaur, which was known as Stenonychosaurus inequalis, if you want to say that real fast after a couple of drinks. And they said, what would this creature have looked like if it had been allowed to evolve and not died off? And based on all the scientific principles of trends of physiological and physical trends the creature had shown in its history, they extrapolated that forward, and they came out with a model that was of a humanoid reptile, very much like what the ancients have been talking about and what modern-day men and women, some of our own brothers, sisters, friends, and neighbors who are never talking about it, have encountered these creatures. And so if there's an ounce of possibility that dinosaurs did survive the devastation 65 million years ago to become birds, then just perhaps these other creatures are the root of all the anthropomorphic or humanoid reptilian deities that have been reported throughout histories, and they have been deified not only because of their advanced knowledge and wisdom, but also because we psychologically attach to the serpent image if we can get past the natural revulsion of it, because it may be part of our own genetic memory that's holding the image up like a mirror.
Well, you know, they say beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And,
exactly.
And these images you sent us that we've got linked up with your website, reptoids.com, on coasttocoastam.com. There's one image here that we've got on our homepage you gave us, John, about looks like a human on a table on some kind of exam. And these creatures are ugly. I'll give you that.
Well, you know, I guess you just have to get past it. If it looks like these creatures might be there, we just have to get past it. And if we don't, then we're really just facing our own darkness inside us. Because if we can't get past us, then who are we to believe that we belong in an environment or society deep underground with many different types of various life forms that look very, very different and frightening, perhaps?
At what point, then, in their evolution, did the brain start to change? Because they weren't always as intelligent as they are now, apparently, right?
Well, we can only assume, given natural course of nature, that, you know, intelligence is something gained over long periods of time through different mutations and information being passed through the eyes and the ears and the skin down to our sensory input being put back to our brain, and our brain translating it down to a genetic level and impregnating it in that DNA. Actual memory impregnated into that DNA, not only memory of physical types, but perhaps perceptual things. And if we're talking about how does a creature identify a poisonous plant when it's never eaten it before and nobody ever taught it?
Good point.
It's because there's some inherent intuition, we call it. Intuition. It's a genetic thing that tells you don't eat that plant.
How do they know not to jump off the edge of a cliff, for
example?
Well,
everybody does but the lemmings.
Yeah.
And we can't figure them out.
Yeah.
We can't figure them out. But then why does human society allow the continuance of a war-making economy, a global war-making economy, with being told that they're really seeking peace when it actually is against the economic sense to seek peace when you create weapons of war? How can we allow that to continue also? Why are we so self-destructive as a human species without standing up saying enough is enough?
Is it the nature? How many of these creatures do you think are underneath in the hollow portion of the planet?
Well, that's hard to determine, George. We're talking about, reservedly, zoologists estimate there's probably about 100 to 125 million life forms that have not yet made contact with humans.
On this planet?
On this planet. We know so little about life on this planet, it doesn't make sense for us to be staring out into space. For very few people who ever get the time to sit at those telescopes, staring off into space into some far-outreached, you know, universe, when we should be turning our eyes towards our own planet and figuring out how are we going to solve climate change? How are we going to come? Can we reach out into our planet to see if there are other aliens even here that may have survived as perhaps castaways or something like
well,
that, or
was,
even visitors that could give us the answers or help us to rectify the problem.
Do you think these reptoids developed on this planet, as you've pointed out, or is it possible they came here from above and they just stayed?
I believe that this was originally their planet, and that humans were later
popped in
as perhaps castaways, like I said,
mm-hmm.
maybe from a nearby planet that became inhospitable or blew up and became an asteroid belt or something like that. and that's why they were the caretakers of the garden originally, and then we have these new beings coming down, and they're supposed to be sharing, and they perhaps had difficulty with that. So it's the whole issue of, you know, of the Adam and Eve of various cultures, going all the way back to the Hopi Indians, to the Navajo Indians, to the Tibetans, to the Greeks, to all the Egyptians. If you look around the world, you'll never see any one image other than a bird being presented as a religious form.
True.
In all these different countries. Why is it that human beings became so psychologically attached to this image? And so we're talking about creatures that may actually have evolved here, if I may use that word, and over a given period of time, they have lived parallel to ourselves in a parallel society deep underground. My personal belief at this point, after all these years of looking into this, is that their society may be being held hostage to their own social progress, as well as our own, by individuals, both alien and human, who are profiting off of aggression and off of fear. And it may be that our leaders and their leaders entertain a fear between the two species simply because they just don't want there to be peace, because there's no profit in peace and there's no control without fear,
now,
they believe.
How often, if they're there, do they come to the surface, if at all?
Well, over, if you put your ear to the rail in the UFO community, you're going to hear a large train coming. And I'm telling you that everybody is starting to turn around and talk about reptoids. It's because we went through these various stages of indoctrination or desensitization to the off-worlders or other-than-human creatures or beings. We had the Space Brothers of the 50s and 60s. We had the Greys pop up, and then they didn't mean anything to us anymore. It wasn't that frightening of image. And now we have an approaching symbol that's about to be entertained in our near future at a time when chaos and war and all kinds of different types of devastations may be actually ruling the planet. And, of course, this fits it right in with the apocalypse or Revelation when they talk about the end of the world and the return of the dragon. Because as you may have been already aware of, because you sound quite schooled in this area, George, is that in the great books, it's usually we start with the serpent, and in the end, we end with a dragon or
right.
a serpent. And it's kind of like the Ouroboros, the symbol of the serpent with the tail its tail in its mouth.
One would endless cycle. One would assume, then, that these reptoids may not be too friendly.
Some of them are not friendly, just as there are some humans that I would not want to entertain a night out with at the movies or something.
That's true. That's
right.
True.
This polarity is not, you can't say something looks like this, so it is this. That's been our danger since we've been early man. People, if you suddenly don't want people to like the Japanese, like in World War II, all of a sudden all the magazines and newspapers, they are showing them as little demonic little creatures. I mean, it was really derogatory. So, you know, we have to be careful of how that image is presented to us. And if somebody's presenting them as all evil, that person should be looked at as a possible vehicle for this continuance of fear and control over us.
Do you think, we're coming up to the top of the hour very quickly, John, are they shapeshifters as well, or are they just pure reptoids?
No, I believe some of them may be using technologies that can actually affect the atomic mass of the cell structures of their bodies to move them in and out of phase shift with our visible
okay.
and detectable
all right.
reality.
We're going to talk a little bit of Arthur C. Clarke and his work that you just mentioned, Childhood End. We'll also talk about some of the things David Icke has talked about, because he talked about reptilians as well. And let's find out where you think they are exactly on this planet. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. Our guest is John Rhodes. His website is reptoids.com. It's linked up. Don't have to worry about spelling it right now. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com.